All right, so we are in 1 Peter 2. We're looking at verses 13 through 17. This really is, we talked about 11 and 12 on Wednesday night, where he talks about the fact that we are sojourners, we're exiles, we're aliens. So we are in a land that is not our own. And because of that, we face an enemy. There's always an enemy when you're not in your own land. And because of that, we have to be aware, be on the alert. And he tells them how they are to act as aliens and exiles, and that is that you are to conduct yourselves among the Gentiles in an honorable way, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. And so now we are getting into verse 13, and he goes into talking about, this is the second phase of this book that we're looking at now, looking more in terms of external relationships that exist because you are aliens and exiles, because you are have been reborn. There are things that have changed in terms of your relationship to governors, to the government, in terms of your relationship between a master and a slave, and then, as we'll see in chapter 3, the husband and wife relationship. All right, so he says to be subject for the Lord's sake, and we just noted the fact that really from here to chapter 4 and verse 11 or so, that this is the key phrase to help us understand what he's talking about. If we keep this in the forefront of our minds as we look at these different relationships, it's going to help us. And that is that we need to be subject for the Lord's sake. Keep that. He wants that to be the focus of the commands that he's going to give each of these different relationships, whether it be verses 13 through 17 with the government, you be subject to them for the Lord's sake because of Jesus. In verses 18 through 25, the master-slave, slaves, you be subject to your masters for the Lord's sake. And then in chapter 3, he's going to deal with the husband and the wife. And the wife, you are to be subject to the husband, and it's for the Lord's sake. Okay? So that needs to be at the forefront. And he says to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor as supreme, and some translate it as be subject to every human institution, it may be better to translate it as every human authority. In other words, wherever there's an authority figure in place, be subject. And specifically, he talks about that in the three areas that we just mentioned. I do think it's important that we realize that as we read through this, this was something that would have been very difficult for these Christians. This wasn't an easy task or an easy command that was given them. This was very difficult for them. And yet, I don't think it's any easier in our day and time. We all have to work at it. And I mean, when you think about our country, what we were founded on, individual liberty and freedom, you know, the concept of subjection, especially when we don't think we've been treated fairly, is something that as an American culture we're allergic to. And so there's a great amount of humility that is required of us in order to carry out these type of commands that Peter's talking about. And so as we read through this, I just want us to be careful. Sometimes it's easy, I know it's easy for me, to read these passages and kind of look for the loopholes. But that's not really a great Bible strategy when we're studying texts, especially texts like this. God's Word isn't tailored to make us comfortable. We have to tailor our emotions to His will. And so as we look at that, just keep these things in mind. So he says, be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor as supreme. And the emperor is actually translated here as king, but either way, he's referring to the head guy, the head honcho. And he says, the emperor as supreme. In John 19, remember the Jews said, we had no king but Caesar. So when you think about the emperor, if this is as it's translated as king here, you'd be talking about the Caesar here at this time. You'd be subject to them. Even Jesus, and this isn't the whole point of this of all of this, but this is one thing I think we can say about Jesus. Remember when he was showed the coin and Caesar's inscription was on it? He says, "You render to Caesar what's Caesar and to God what's God's." And I think there is an element to Jesus there. Again, that's not the whole point of that text. But there is an element of being subject to the government that God has set in place. And then he says to be subject after emperor to who? All right, to the governor. Okay, to the governors, that's right. And these would have been those who would have been set as ruler over specific regions of the king or the emperor. So you could think about some examples like Pilate, Festus, and Felix. Those would be some examples where the Caesar would have set certain rulers who were below him in different areas of the land that, that he was ruling over. I want to think about Paul's actions for just a moment in the book of Acts. I think it's kind of a helpful way to think about this, because Paul was very careful and scrupulous in terms of his attention to obeying authority. When you think about the conversion of the Philippian jailer, if you'll recall there, they were very savagely beaten, weren't they? And they were thrown into jail. The Philippian jailer was converted. But where are Paul and Silas the very next day? Anybody remember? They're back in prison. And this is where they find out that he's a Roman citizen. And remember what they try to do? They try to keep it hush-hush. They don't want anybody to know that they treated a Roman citizen the way they have. And so they try to just get Paul out of the city with this going unnoticed. And what is it that Paul made them do? What did he want them to do? He wanted them to publicly apologize to him, more or less. And the reason that Paul did that is, I think, what it's important. He's getting ready to leave a region. And as he's leaving the region, he doesn't want Christians to think that they are that they're under the impression that illegality is okay. And so he wants to be cleared of any wrongdoing before he leaves, so everyone understands that he's not trying to defy the government. And I think that says a lot about Paul. Yes, he was treated very badly. He was harassed and persecuted in some very awful ways and then thrown in jail. But that didn't stop him from trying to be the Christian that Peter talks about here. Being subject to the government, which, you know, as you go through the book of Acts, a lot of the Jewish people who were trying to persecute the Christians, they were trying to make it look like Christians were overthrowing the government. And Paul's trying to make it clear, I'm trying to comply with the government. And so I think it's a good example to try and look at how Paul handles a situation like that. Yes, he was treated unfairly, but he is trying to be subject to the government for the Lord's sake. All right, so he says, be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor as supreme or to governors as sent by him to punish those who do evil and praise those who do good. And you may recall that Paul mentioned similar things about the civil government or in terms of its purpose in Romans chapter 13. If you'll notice then here in 1 Peter 2 and verse 15, he says, this is the will of God, that by doing good, you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. And again, if you go back to verse 12, he's already talked about this a little bit. So I want to go back to the example of Daniel. Remember Wednesday night we talked about Daniel's is a good example of how we see this kind of commandment play out. That he is first subject to the king, God himself, but then he's subject to those who are under God, who God has put in control. And so Daniel's a good example, I think, to kind of help us see how he carries this out, where he's not compromised. He's a good example of not compromising his loyalty to God. And can you think of an example where he wasn't willing to compromise his faithfulness to God? There's a few examples in the book of Daniel. That's right. You know, they were trying to find a way, some of those who were serving the king, were trying to find a way to get rid of Daniel. And they put this decree that they weren't that you weren't allowed to pray to any god but the king or his gods. And what we find is that Daniel, instead of obeying that, he goes up to his room just like he always has, opens his door towards his land, and he starts praying to God. That is an example of where, when it comes to your faithfulness to God or obeying the government that God has put there, he's going to obey God first. That's an example of being subject for the Lord's sake, but keeping the Lord as the primary focus. And yet, at the same time, what would be an example where Daniel does good for the sake of this king that he is now under in Babylon, where he does good for government? Can you think of one? Okay. Yeah, so that is a good point. He conducts himself the way Peter talks about and does good. And while he does good, keeping his customs, keeping his faithfulness to God, you find him moving up in the ranks and serving the king in his court. What about simply the example of interpreting dreams for the king? That was, in a sense, an act of good that Daniel does for a king who, you know, if you're a Jew, I'm not sure, if I put myself in the place of Daniel as a Jew, my homeland's gone, they've just come in and destroyed it, and now they left all the poor people and the weak people back home, and they've taken all the wise and intelligent back to Babylon, and now you're being asked to serve the king. That's not necessarily what I would be thinking of wanting to do at the moment. But Daniel was called upon. He was known to be one who could interpret the dreams of the king. And he goes and he does it. That is an act of good for someone who wasn't necessarily a very godly king. And as Dan pointed out, over time you kind of see that because of his acts of goodness, he climbs the ladders in terms of rank, and he acts on behalf of the king as a godly, God-fearing man. So I think that's a good example to kind of help us see what Peter's getting at. It could have been somebody, Daniel could have just said, I'm not going to serve this king. I'm not going to even interpret these dreams for him. Look at what he's done to my homeland. But that's not how he ended up acting. Yeah, Mark?
It goes to say whether we think they're legitimate or not. Because even Paul in Acts 23, he's before the council, he had mentioned he lived in all the country. But this day, Ananias commanded that he be struck on the mountain.
Right.
Then it's brought to his attention that he was talking to the high priest. Now, Ananias wasn't a legitimate high priest, but he was in that position and recognized it as such. And Paul very quickly says, I did not know, brethren, that he was the high priest, for it is written, you shall not speak evil of the ruler of your people. So, regardless.
Right.
And he felt like he had done right.
Yeah.
So when Peter says honor the king, it has nothing to do with our opinion of the king.
That's right. Yeah, that's an excellent point. Paul did that over and over again, showing his respect for the authority. And I think that's what you see even in that's another good example, Mark, because when we're looking at Peter, we're going to talk about this in a moment, but, you know, while Nero was a legitimate Caesar, according to Roman standards, he wasn't a legitimate person, a Christian. He wasn't a Christian. And so from that standpoint, you can see how, well, he's not a Christian. He does these things so terribly wrong. He persecutes people. And so we're not going to subject ourselves to him. And that, you see that with Paul, that even though this wasn't a legitimate high priest, he was going to do his best to be respectful of that position. Yeah, very good point. Let's turn over to Jeremiah 29. Jeremiah 29, and by the way, not only Daniel, but you can even look at Joseph, who's a good example as well, where he's taken away from his homeland. His brothers hated him and sold him, and he goes into a foreign land where he's an alien and he's in exile, and he is respectful and subject to Potiphar, even though he was treated poorly by Potiphar's wife. He's thrown in jail, and what does he do? He does good by interpreting dreams. And then he's taken out and he's put into second in command. So even though you're in foreign territory and you are a godly man among many who aren't godly, if you do good, good things will happen. Not necessarily all the time, but you know in terms of your relationship to God, God is going to take care of you. So here's another example in Jeremiah 29. We know this section pretty well. Because God is talking about them, you might as well make your new home in Babylon. You're not going back anytime soon. So look at verse 4. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, to all the exiles whom I have sent into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. All right, so we have these people who are exiles. They're aliens in a foreign land. Verse 5, build houses and live in them. Plant gardens and eat their produce. Take wives and have sons and daughters. Take wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage, that they may bear sons and daughters. Multiply there and do not decrease. Then notice what he says here in verse 7. But seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile and pray to the Lord on its behalf. For in its welfare, you will find your welfare. So notice, this is the exact situation that Joseph was in, that Daniel was in, that these Christians that Peter's writing to are in. They're exiles. And Jeremiah's message to Israel here, who are exiles in Babylon, is no different from the message that Peter talks about, is no different from the way Paul acted, from the way Daniel acted, from the way Joseph acted. He tells them, you seek the welfare of this city which just went across and demolished your homeland. This is the prayer that they were to offer on behalf of the land that they were living in. And, you know, if you're a hardcore Jewish nationalist, that's probably not a prayer you're going to be offering up. But they are more than that. They are God's people. And Peter's instructions to his exile listeners is, you know, I want you to do good. And in the process, you're going to hush up these people who are hurling false accusations about you. And his point is they're no different than Jeremiah's instructions to his exile listeners. So there's no different from what Daniel did or Joseph did. And I think that's a pretty cool, that's a pattern, a legitimate pattern that you see from the beginning of the Bible all the way to the end. It's a pattern of God's people who are exiles living in a land that's not theirs. And they're simply told to do good, whether the government is good or not, because it's for the Lord's sake. That's right. That's right. Jesus is it's the same. Always is the same. He's consistent across the line, right? And we are to do the same. We are to act as Jesus acted. That's exactly right. And so, obviously, the same would apply to us, wouldn't it? We are in a world that's not. We're in the world, but we're not of the world. Our citizenship is in heaven. Our loyalty is to Jesus. But in that process, we subject ourselves to authority and we do good so that we can silence the ignorant and foolish people of the world. There's another comment I want to make here. If Peter wrote, if you want to go back to 1 Peter now, if Peter wrote this in the early 60s A.D., it's typically common for people to say, well, you know who the emperor around this time was. And who was the emperor? We've already talked about it. It's Nero. That's right. And, you know, there's no way to know for sure, but that is certainly probable that is who this Caesar is. And it's almost certain that Nero was the emperor when Paul writes Romans. And what you see in Romans 13 and in 1 Peter is the apostles say things like, who would be there to harm you if you do what's good? So then we say, well, wait a minute. Isn't Nero the guy who fed Christians to lions and poured tar on them and lit them on fire? And yet, these passages about the government and doing good, how does all that gel? And I would just ask us to keep in mind that there's another book in the New Testament that talks about government and authority, and it does so in a very negative way. And what book would that be? It's a scary book to a lot of people. The book of Revelation, right? And there's actually a very weird contrast between Romans 13 and Revelation 13, which is talking about the same thing, but has a whole different spin on it. And there's a reason for that. Nero himself was not pure evil incarnate from the get-go. And really, in fact, if you all know anything about Roman history, you'll realize that the first 5 years of his reign as Caesar, they were called the five golden years of his reign. And part of that's because of the political advisor that he had, which was Seneca. And so he was a crazy man, but he wasn't necessarily crazy, crazy, crazy from the get-go. So there are some of the first part of his reign, at least the first 5 years or so, were fairly decent. It wasn't till the end of his reign when he became really crazy and started persecuting a lot of the Christians. In fact, the Senate wanted to put him to death, and they were on their way to go kill him, and he decided to hang himself and kill himself. He committed suicide. So I just point all that out. Because we need to do our best to read the Bible in its context. And context often means to look at the historical context. And so, to be fair to the Scriptures, we have to realize the reason why passages like Romans 13 and 1 Peter 2 talk about the civil government in a fairly positive terms, terms that express situations like what you see in the book of Acts, especially where many times you see the Roman authorities take the side of a Christian, or at least put a stop to the persecution that they're going through. I mean, you see that over and over again in the book of Acts. So change does take place in the mid-60s And that's when the city of Rome is burned, and that's when Nero starts to blame the Christians, or those, he blames it on these strange people with their weird new religion. And so, anyway, that's why, that's kind of how things shape out in the New Testament, what you see later on in a book like Revelation, which I think probably clearly has in mind Nero and the great Roman Empire. And the image is that of a great and terrible beast, a monster, which is pure evil. And so we need to have a full view, I think, of what the Bible says about government. At its worst, it can be awful, right? It can be very terrible. But in principle, it can be pretty good. And as exiles, you need to live in subjection to authority, but first of all, to God for His sake. All right, any questions up to that point? All right, so this last little bit here, he says, live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God. Honor everyone, love the brotherhood, fear God, and honor the emperor. So there are four instructions here, and the first and last one begin with the same command, which is honor. When you have a list in the Bible, and the first and last things are the same, and you have a bunch of things included in the middle, what kind of structure do you call that? Yeah, bookends. Bookends and inclusio, something like that. You have a sandwich, and that sandwich was bookended by a single topic, and in the middle you have kind of the meat of the sandwich, the meat of the sandwich here. So he says, honor everyone, honor the emperor, and sandwich in between is what? It's kind of more internal, right? You love the brotherhood and you fear God. And really, in order to extend your respect to what is external, it's going to start with how you respect each other and love each other. If we love each other here, and we're doing that with pure motives, that should extend itself out to how we act towards those on the outside. And so it's kind of like on the outside you have outsiders, on the inside is the internal commitment as Christians. Yeah, Kevin?
We were using Daniel there as an example of being subject to the foreign government.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And that's the way that we should be. We shouldn't be able, as Christians, we shouldn't be where somebody can accuse us of, you know, doing wrong, you know, wrongdoing. You know, if they're going to accuse us of being as serving God, that's where they can find it. And so if we're going to be at odds with the government, it's going to be wherever the government will be requiring us to do something that violates, you know, God's will.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. We always need to be living in such a way that there's no, you know, they can't bring any accusation against us. You know, it's interesting when you think about Jesus. You know, he told his followers, that there are going to be times when you're going to face some hardship and you're going to be brought before emperors and government. And you need to be ready for that. And, you know, Peter tells them how to be ready. You do good. You simply live a good life. You do what you need to do, and the rest will take care of itself. If you don't do that, that's when they're going to be able to find fault. So, yeah, that's a good point, Kevin.
And even then, I mean, you don't see, like, those guys going out and performing some massive protest or something.
Right.
They just continued to serve God. They didn't, like, make it a political argument, which they probably weren't in a position to. But they just continued to do what was right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly right. It's simple in principle in terms of how we are to respond. You just be good. Just do good. That seems simple, but it's very difficult to do that. Mr. Byers was talking to me Wednesday night after class, because we were talking about keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable. And he just made the point that he's telling them to do really what is unnatural in our minds. If somebody is coming against you and accusing you as an evildoer, my first instinct would not be necessarily to do good. I wish it would. I hope it would. But our first instinct is to defend ourselves and to fight back. And he's telling them to do something that's... It's extremely difficult to do that. But I think it gets easier the more we draw closer to the Lord. It should. Yeah, Mark?
The retaliation should be what Paul tells Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 2. He says, I first of all want you to pray. So,
yeah.
You know, that's really the first place we protest, if you will, is our prayer. But there's something that he said after that in terms of why you pray for kings is that you may live quiet. That's what's acceptable to the Lord. So it's certainly what men see in us, and even Peter has alluded to this. He says that even when they speak of you as evildoers, they see your works, your good works, and they'll glorify God. So if there's anything that should speak loudly, that's what should speak loudly is the good works, not necessarily that you're holding a sign and marching on Washington. That's not necessarily going to get the job done.
Right. That's right. That's exactly right. Good point. All right. Anything else? All right. This next set of relationships that we're looking at is going to be 18 through 25, which deals with the master and the slave relationship. And it's sometimes tough for us when we read this, because we tend to only read the Bible from our point of view rather than its own context. And there are some things that I want us to realize as we look at this next section. First of all, slavery is terrible. However, there are some very fundamental differences between slavery in the first century and really slavery as we know it from our history in our country. And I just want to spend a little bit of time thinking about that as we move into this, so we can see what Peter is trying to get at. So I would encourage us to try not to interpret what you read in the biblical text about slavery from the perspective of slavery in our countries, from our country's historical perspective, okay? When you think about Peter's instructions. Slavery in the first century was not based on racial considerations. And whereas slavery in our country was based on theories of racial superiority and inferiority. And so I think that's important for us to understand that. Race really played no part in terms of slavery in the first century. In fact, slaves were made up of all kinds of different backgrounds and race. You had, whether it was that they came from the idea of being a prisoner of war, some of them voluntarily became slaves. They wanted to become slaves. That was the life that they chose, or the path that they chose. And there's some reasons why, and we'll talk about that. another thing to consider is that education was greatly discouraged in our American culture in terms of American slaves, because it was considered a threat. But when you looked at the first century, that was quite a different thing altogether. In fact, many slaves were better educated than their masters were in a lot of different circumstances. Another thing to consider is that slaves were allowed to own property, and they were even allowed to own their own slaves. And so the idea of slave or slavery was more appealing than during our time in the Civil War era. So I wanted to keep some of that in mind. I want you to consider 1 Corinthians chapter 7. When Paul talks about different circumstances in life, he says, "Are any of you slaves? Seek to be free. Are any of you free? Don't become a slave." And you might begin to ask yourself, well, who would want to be a slave in the first place? And you definitely didn't want to in terms of American slavery. But I just simply wanted to see that that could have been a very lucrative pathway in the first century. It was a pathway that many times led to money. It was a pathway that led to citizenship. And that in the practice, typically the practice in the first century is by the age of 30, they were typically released. The slaves were released to go on their way. So they had a good amount of time there where they would work, they would gather money, and they would just, you know, that would be a good nest egg for them. And by the age of 30, they were let go. And they had quite a bit of money to go and carry on the life that they wanted to live after a slave. And so if you voluntarily did that and you got yourself in a good situation where you had a good master and you were set free with a good nest egg, that was a pretty good life. The other thing I want us to consider, though, is that in the first century, slaves were considered property. In fact, if you read in the Moral Philosopher's Instructions that are addressed to husbands and wives, and we're going to look at that when we get to the husband and wife section, they deal with husbands, they deal with wives, and they deal with masters. But there's nothing said by the philosophers on those who were slaves. And it's because they were viewed as non-entities from a pagan perspective. Okay. The reason I point that out is because from a New Testament perspective, the New Testament is unique. Because it does give instructions to those who are slaves. From a New Testament point of view, if you are in Jesus, there is neither what? That's right, there's neither slave nor free, because all are in Christ. All are one in Christ. And the reason that I think it's important that we remember all of this background as we get into this is because there are extreme radical atheists that will attack Christians. And they will go to this very idea here, and particularly this idea of slavery, primarily because they know that this is a problem that they know they can exploit from a perspective of our American culture. We love liberty, right? We love freedom. And they'll make statements like, why didn't they just tell the masters to just let their slaves go? Why was it directed to the slave? Why didn't he just tell the master, you just let the slave go, and then we won't even have to worry about a command to a slave to be subject to his master? And they make arguments like that. And so there's a couple things I want to say in response to that. I don't know if you You all probably heard Sid talk about this. I know I've talked to some of you about this as well. There's a book called The Benedict Option. I don't know if you all have heard of this or not. I recommend you read it. Be careful. The guy who wrote it is was a Catholic, and I think he's Orthodox now. But what he does, I think, is very interesting in his perspective on some things. He talks about how to change a world, how to change souls. And there are two ways, he says, that you can really affect change in society. First of all, you can change the big social structures externally, and then from that, you can change all the people who are in those structures. An outside approach. But then, secondly, you can change people individually. And through those individual transformations, change will take place. Change will happen. If you don't change those people as you change the external, will you have much success? No, you're not going to have much success. My point is, you don't see the apostles too interested in turning the Greco-Roman Empire or establishment upside down. You don't see them trying to do that. They're more intent on changing the culture by way of changing individuals and changing people. And so what they did was they focused on changing people, their hearts. And so that's why you have things like they created churches who were colonies. In a world that has its values all distorted in order to show that the world is how it's supposed to be. Out there, the philosophy is you hate people. In here, there is neither Jew nor Greek. Out there, you treat people like property. In here, there is neither slave nor free. And that's why the New Testament is so unique compared to what these moral philosophers wrote, who never even mentioned slaves at all. The New Testament does, because they tried to change individuals, and they knew that was the only way that a culture could be changed. It wasn't by fighting the government. Okay? So keep that in mind, and then we'll start looking at the commands to these slaves here. Thank you all.